This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Good afternoon once again, and welcome to Trainer Talk, presented by Basic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, my producer Lee Della Pina. We are in studio here in Lexington, Kentucky, where each and every week on this particular show, we have the opportunity to visit with so many of the people that make the sport a success. And you know I'm talking about the trainers and the dedication. I tell you about that every week. The dedication that these individuals have, the commitment that they have to the sport, it is really a labor of love. And I love hearing the stories of all of the trainers that we get a chance to talk to here on Trainer Talk, presented by Basic Tipton. So without further ado, let's get started here tonight. It's going to be a fun show. A couple of outstanding trainers on the docket, including our first guest, the 54-year-old native of Buenos Aires, Argentina, who has saddled 58 winners. His runners have earned $2.4 million in purses, but that doesn't even begin to tell the story of trainer Ignacio Correas. He is nice enough to spend a little time with me here this afternoon on Trainer Talk. And Ignacio, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for inviting me to the show, and good afternoon to everybody.
Yeah, happy to have you on board with me here this afternoon. And you know, your family, Ignacio, has been involved with training horses for what, more than a century? Is that right?
Yeah, well, I think it was my great-grandfather used to own horses since 1872, but we started breeding in 1876. So it's been a pretty, you know, wild.
So it's safe to say that this has always been in your blood?
I would think so, yes. Because on my mother's side also, they were breeders, you know, the fire family, they were breeders too. So I guess that, you know, horse racing have been always in my family and, you know, was like something that we talked daily about, you know. It was something that I would say that all the family have in common.
How much different is racing looked upon in Argentina as opposed here in the United States?
Well, it's very different. I mean, it's like if I have to describe, you know, what Argentina is in racing, is, you know, it's like, we have two big markets, you know, Europe, namely England, France, Ireland, and then you have, you know, the United States. And I would think that Argentina is like kind of a mix of both. I mean, even if it was more European like 30 years ago, it's tending to get more, you know, the American way lately, and over the last 20 years or so. But I would think there is something in the mix. I mean, it's like you have to define. You go, you know, for stayers in the grass in Europe, and you go for sprinting in, you know, and dirt in America. I think that we have a little bit of both. So it will be something in the middle. But training-wise, that I think that you have to be very respectful of where you train. You cannot train horses in America like in Argentina. Or train horses in America like in Europe. You have to adapt yourself to the way of training, you know. That's for me, that's the biggest key. You have to be very, you know, open your eyes, listen to the ones that have been successful, learn from them, and try to get, you know, the best of each one and use it, you know, in your benefit.
How difficult has that adjustment been for you, Ignacio?
Well, I always have been pretty adaptable. I mean, I train on the three racetracks in Argentina, and they're all very different. And then I train in the farm, and then I go back to the track. So, I mean, I always have been very adaptable. But, I mean, it's like when I started here working as assistant for Billy Vadid, it was, you know, there was a big difference for me, the way, not that much of training, the way we work with the horses, you know, on the barn, than, you know, than the track, if you want. But I don't think it was difficult. I mean, it's like any, you know, kind of learning process that you need, you know, some things, you know, it's like it's shocking in the first 2-3 months until you start understanding everything. It happened to me when I worked in Europe, you know, the first 2-3 months, it was, oh, what is this, you know, why these guys are doing this? And then when you start, you know, seeing the whole picture instead of little things here and there, you know, you start to understand, you know, how the game is going to play, what you're going to do. And then, you know, if you have been, you know, blessed like I am, that I've been spent the rest, almost all my life with horses and in many places in the world, you can pick things that you have seen, you know, in other places that might, you know, fit for a certain horse.
Sure.
So that's the, I mean, that's, you know, when you, I have been very blessed to be able to work in many places. So I learned from, you know, so many people that, you know, you can always have something on a horse. Oh, I saw it, you know, somewhere, did this, did that. And if not, I never had a problem of picking up the phone and call someone and asking for advice. I mean, I think that you need to keep your mind very open to this game. It's always the day that you stop learning, for me, that's the day that you are done.
Yeah, yeah. How old were you when you were first exposed to horse racing in Argentina?
I don't know, probably that I remember. I mean, I probably was in the racing when I was a baby, but I mean, it's like that I recall is going to the racing when I was like 5.
Yep.
You're sold not to the grandstand because we were not allowed, but in the summers, on the spring, they put us, you know, in the infield.
Yep.
They had, you know, like ice cream and things for the kids so the parents, you know, can go to the races. There was not that much TV at the time, so everybody went to the races. So, and my father was in the commission, the racing commission, so he dropped us there in the gardens, in the infield. We play with all the other kids, all the other people, and watch the races from there. And instead of betting money, we bet for ice creams and that kind of stuff.
Wow. Which family member had the biggest influence on you getting involved in horse racing?
I don't know, I think, of course, my father in general, but in training, it wasn't no one in my family, actually. I mean, it's like in 1979, I went to Europe and I spent some time in the national stud in Spain. And then I went to France to go to Kennet, to Alex Fett, place, farm, breeding farm in France. And so he asked me if I want to stay, you know, a few weeks in the training before I go to the farm. I say, yeah, sure. And then I spend most of the time. I went to Kennet because my father, if not, would kill me. But I went, I think, 2 weeks to Kennet, and I spent the rest, like, 5 or 6 months there in the training with him. I mean, it was a great experience. And I think that that's when I decided, oh, well, this is what I want to do. So, he was the inspiration, you can say. But, you know, the one that said, okay, this is what I want to do, you know, the rest of my life.
What went into the decision to come here to the United States and relocate?
That was made in 2001. The country was going through a very bad time. I mean, we got robbed on our house a couple of times. And, you know, I told my wife, you know, it's time to get out of here. So we contacted Mrs. Perkins, Wimmore farm owner,
mm-hmm.
that I used to train for her in Argentina. And I say, you know what, I want to go to the States and think that you can get me, you know, help me to get a job there. So he said, you want to train? I said, no, I prefer to help someone until I learn, you know, how this works. And so, like, I mean, I was thinking always, you know, well, this process is going to take a year or so. the next week, you know, Billy Budget called me, and so I came to visit him to Saratoga, and then I came and I worked for a year with him. It was a good learning experience. Then I went to Hickory Tree Farm to do some layups and break babies. Then I went to Kentucky, worked for David Banks for a little bit, and then I got the call from Mr. Curry from California, and I spent 5 years with him in California. They were great. We actually did very good. We had Stormelo, Memoret, Fun Logic, Freeze Good, a lot of stake horses, Dr. Flanker, Bushwhacker. I mean, we have a bunch of good horses. I mean, we had a lot of fun, and we did pretty good. And then I went to Louisiana for a little bit for Southern Equine, and that's when I was heading back to California to train is when Dan Rosenberg, because of the advice of Dan Liebman, contacted me through my brother. They were working together. He was advisor for the farm of my brother, that my brother works in Argentina. Contacted me and asked me, you know, to go visit with Mr. Mulligan, that was general manager of Nice, the general manager of Sagamore. So I came to Sagamore. It's tough not to fall in love with Sagamore, even if it wasn't, you know, what it is today. We were just starting. But, I mean, the project seems, you know, something that, you know, there was history. I mean, it's like, it's the history of racing. So that attracted to me a lot. And I thought that, you know, if they give me if they were so kind to give me the opportunity to show what I can do, I mean, it's like it was, I mean, I was all in. And we started working here, and here we are.
Talking with Ignacio Correas.
Trying to do the best we can.
Ignacio Correas on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, and mentioning Sagamore, coming there in 2009. And quite honestly, Ignacio, hearing your story and hearing all of the different places that you've had to travel to just to be involved with this sport, you know, I think that so many people in this game don't realize that trainers pay their dues on so many different levels. And I think it's safe to say that you have certainly done that. And you talk about being involved with breaking horses and working in the barns and, you know, really learning from the ground up. How much has that helped you now when you're working with these horses at Sagamore?
Well, to tell you the truth, I mean, I really like that. I mean, it's not something that I was used to do. I mean, I was like almost an irregular trainer. I mean, even if in Argentina I was more involved with farms, so I always knew. Even if I didn't have, you know, the background from that horse from, you know, as a yearling or so, I mean, I knew the family, or, you know, I have, you know, some kind of connection with all that. I think that is important to me to know. You know, when you train brothers and sisters and, you know, families, you know how they behave, you know, you know what you can expect a little bit more of them. And the fact that we got, you know, we breed to race, so I see those babies when they have days. I mean, I follow them when they're weanlings and then yearlings. I get them when they're yearlings. I break them. We break them at the farm. I mean, and it's, I think that makes my job a lot easier, because when I get to train that horse, I probably already know that one for a year or a year and a half. So I know at least his personality, what he likes, what he don't like. It helps a lot. I mean, of course, you can do that with the amount of horses that we train. I don't know if we wouldn't be able to do that, you know, at that personal level in a bigger scale. But I think that is important. All the time that you can spend with a horse. I mean, the only thing that, I mean, that I was taught is you have to look at them, you know. So you look at them. You need to learn how to read them. You're going to make mistakes. And with some of them, you're going to be right. Some of them, you're going to be wrong. But you have to keep trying and trying to get them where you want. I mean, there's so many roads to go to the same place, and everybody is right. I mean, it's like you have to find the one that suits your horse only, or the one that you think that suits your horse. That will be the right answer, the one that you think that suits your horse.
And it sounds like you've never stopped learning. Is that right?
Well, I mean, it's like, I think that, I don't think that I will never, I mean, I think that curiosity is great. You know, I mean, it's like, you always need to want more, learn more. I mean, I was very lucky to spend, you know, this winter was my first winter in Florida. I was at Payson Park. I mean, there were so many nice people, so many great trainers there, Maud, Clement, Atfield, Black. And McGee, I mean, when you get to pick the brains, I mean, it's very nice, you know. You don't get really, if you are in New York, you don't get to talk to them like, you know, when you are, you know, every day and there are only 7 or 8 trainers in a place that, you know, you can talk to them, ask questions. I mean, I think that, I mean, I like to learn. I mean, it's like, and for me, it's the day that I don't want to learn anymore is probably because I don't really want to improve, so I probably gonna need another challenge, one other thing to do. Learning is good. You have to always be open, and anyone can teach you. The guy that you less expect is the guy that can teach you something.
Well, and you mentioned some pretty big names: Bill Mott, Shug McGahee, all of those individuals that you had a chance to be around in Florida this year. Which trainers did you look up to as a child or as you were coming up into this industry?
In the United States?
Yeah. Were there U.S. trainers?
In the United States, my father used to have horses with Charlie Whittingham.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, even if I wasn't in the picture, you know, I was training in Argentina. I never came here to knew him. I mean, I knew the stories. I mean, my father was co-owner of Payan, the one that Delmar Handicap. And they ran fourth in the Santa Anita Handicap. I mean, it's like, for me, my always, that's why it was kind of a very good winter for me. My how you say, your example, if you want to say, is Billy Mott is a trainer that I always admire a lot. Christoph that much. I really like him. I think that he's a great trainer. It's not only because he won the Vermont. I mean, he had a plan, and he had a plan early this year, and he got it done. So that's a sign of a, you know, an outstanding trainer.
Well, when we talk about...
You know, when you say, you know, it's easy. I mean, maybe, you know, a lot of people said that, but, you know, when someone tells you, you know, in the month of March or the month of February, I mean, we'd like to do this and that, and he does it in June and in May, that's good.
Yeah.
No matter what you have to say, that's great for a trainer. And it's very, I mean, it's like, you have to be very, you know, he should feel very good.
Well, and when we talk about your situation now, being involved with Sagamore Farm as the lead trainer there, Sagamore, of course, if people don't know, owned by Maryland native Kevin Plank, who is the founder of Under Armour. The farm, steeped in history, established in 1925, probably the most notable runner, native dancer, who won the 1953 Preakness in Belmont, and even the Queen of England kept a broodmare at Sagamore in the mid-1900s. How much of that history were you familiar with when you accepted the position, Ignacio?
Well, I mean, I knew, of course, who Native Dancer was and what Sagamore Farm was. I wasn't that much into the history or know as much as many details that I know right now. But when I came to Sagamore in 2009, you know, it's like when you talk to Mr. Plank or Mulligan or our team, I mean, it's like there is a project. And when we started in an old barn. We didn't have a track. We were breaking the babies in a paddock. And it looks like, you know, oh, where are you going to go with this? And Frank have a vision of what he wants. He's very clear of what he wants, and he's very kind to give us all the resources that we need to, you know, move forward and try to reach the point that what he wants to do. And it was like, you know, when we started, I mean, we don't even have weavings in the doors of the barn. I mean, it was like, okay, here are the horses, you're the trainer, where we go?
You know? Wow.
So, and they were all yearlings. I mean, it was like, I mean, I won't tell you, say, I mean, it's for the few days you think what I'm doing here, you know, it's like, we only have 10 horses, what are we going to do? And then, I mean, you have the resources that are very important, and a man that is all for it, that is really, you know, getting into, you know, hard into racing. I mean, he really respect the tradition of Sagamore. He really have a passion for Sagamore, and he want to, you know, bring back all, you know, the greatness that Sagamore used to have. And I think that we are in a good pace to that. I think that probably we have done a little bit more than we expected in the beginning, for, you know, to do it sooner than we expected, I would say. And I think that, you know, the best, you know, still to come. I mean, as I said, I mean, he's, you know, it's like, he, you know, it's, you understand when you talk with him why he made Under Armour. You know, it's like, we had a bad episode. I mean, a sad episode, not a bad one. I mean, unbad to, you know, burn the new apartment that we had built for the help. They were ready to move in on Monday, and they burned down two nights ago, to scratch. And he came to the farm and looked at that. I said, well, you know what? All the big cities in this country were built after a big fire. So let's turn this down and build again. You know, that's the spirit that he brought, bring to the racing, and that's the spirit that he put on all of us. You know, we keep trying. We're going to try. And if we stumble, we're going to get up and we're going to keep trying.
Yeah.
You know, that's all about. That's all you can do. Just try. Try your best every day, and you're going to get it done.
Well,
as he would say, done, done, done.
Well, and you mentioned the success that you had very early on when you got to Sagamore. It was your very first year, I guess. You joined there in 2009, and then in 2010, talk about a successful year. You end up with a trip to the Breeders' Cup with Humble and Hungry in the juvenile turf. That had to be quite a run.
Yeah, I mean, it was incredible. Let me tell you, I mean, it was something like completely, you know, if you told us in 2009 when I came in September, I mean, that we're going to end up running from the farm. You know, the Breeders' Cup juvenile, I mean, it was kind of... I say, I mean, you were, what are you drinking, you know? But, yeah, been on an amazing run. I mean, this summer in Florida, this winter in Florida was good. I mean, we won some races. We developed some horses. We brought back some horses that won stakes. I mean, we're trying to get better. And hopefully every year is going to be better than the other one. And, you know, we're breeding better horses, no doubt, than when we started. And the proof of that is Graham's Filly, you know, Daring Dancer. I mean, they're getting better and better and better. Our brood pair, the quality of our broodmares, they're improving. The stallions that we send the mares are better. I mean, everything is better. Everything gets better every year. So I think that... Mr. Blank and Tom Molina put a great team together with Bob Feld and Rosenberg, Igor, John, all the guys that work in the farm. I mean, everybody have a piece of this success, from the guy that, you know, from the horse, the one that does the track. Everybody have contributed in some way or another one. So it's very nice to work in a place that, you know, you have the resources and you have the will of everybody to do better every year. Makes things a little bit easier.
Visiting with Ignacio Correas on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Ignacio, just about 3 minutes or so left before we have to wrap things up, but I want to touch on your nickname. You go by Nacho. Where did that come from?
Nacho is, I think, the way that they call it to the Ignacios all around the world. I really hated when I was young. I never liked it. But when I went to California, I guess that for Bill was too hard to say Ignacio. So he just started calling me Nacho. And one day he asked me, do you mind? I said, not really. And so from that day, I was Nacho. So, I mean, and I'm very comfortable with it now. And most of the people from California, and I will say now here, they know me by that nickname, not for my name. So, but it's okay. I mean, I like it now.
Wow.
You get used to things. But it was Bill Purin, the one that started calling me here in America that way.
Now, you also have two sons. Are they involved in racing at all?
Not for now. One is a vet. He's doing a PhD in University of Nebraska Lincoln in virology,
mm-hmm.
and the other one is a soccer coach in Argentina. So not really. I mean, I think that the youngest one is going to end up doing something with horses, but it's something that to be a trainer is something that you need to really want to do it. It's too. It's a hard life. It's a very, it's very, regarding when you have good horses, and it's very fun if it's what you want to do and really want it bad. But if you don't want it bad, you better stay away, because it's every day,
Yeah, yeah.
It's every day, and your horses, is almost the most important thing in your life. I mean, it's like, you miss a lot of things in life, but you get some other things that if you're not in this, if you don't have the passion, you cannot measure them. But when you like this job and when you like what you do, you really appreciate all those things a lot. I mean, and they're worth, doing it. But you really have to like it.
Well, it's pretty evident
so,
that
if at one point they want, they're going to be more than welcome.
Yeah, it's evident that you love what you're doing, and this has always been a passion for you from the very beginning. We talked about your family history and how so many of your family members dating back more than 100 years have been involved with this sport. And Ignacio, you represent the sport with the utmost class, and I can't thank you enough for being part of Trainer Talk here tonight. It's been amazing to hear your story.
Thank you very much for the invite. I really enjoyed the talk, and keep helping us to make this industry more known and better every day.
Great stuff. Ignacio, thanks so much, and all the best moving forward with Kevin Plank and Sagamore.
Thank you very much, Mike.
All right, Ignacio Correas here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Like all of our guests who appear on the program, going to receive a gift courtesy of our sponsor, Flair Equine Nasal Strip. So we'll get those out to Ignacio. And boy, what a story. More than 100 years of training horses in that family. Think they know how to get it done? Yeah. So do we here on Trainer Talk. I'm back with the second half next. Stay tuned. It's Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Why sell at Phasic Tipton's summer selected horses of racing age sale?
Market trends.
Current market trends create huge premiums for horses with recent form.
Timing.
The July 14th sale date falls during transition time for stables and provides meaningful racing opportunities for new owners.
Flexibility.
The online catalog only until time of sale allows for entries to be taken up to 1 week prior to the sale date.
Innovation.
The online catalog features updated pedigrees and race records as they occur, along with Rogozin sheet numbers and race replays.
Graduate success.
2013 sales grads are off to a fast start, including Grade 3 winner Candyman E and stakes winners El Sano, Chow Bella Luna, Home Run Birdie, and Jaycito. Last year's inaugural sale was a tremendous success, with an average of $105,000, a median of $45,000, with a low RNA rate of just 15%. The Phasic Tipton Summer Selected Horses of Racing Age Sale, Monday, July 14th in Lexington, Kentucky. Visit phasictipton.com for more information.
The New York Thoroughbred Breeding and Development Fund means business for New York. Together with all equine pursuits in the Empire State, we pay more than $187 million in taxes and provide 33,000 jobs. We provide scholarships for young people who want to join the New York horse industry, and we encourage everyone to support all thoroughbreds all their lives. Visit nybreds.com to learn more about why the fund means business.
Breathing easy is the key to equine performance and health. That's why horsemen around the world count on Flair nasal strips to protect the lungs of their equine athletes without drugs. Flair Strip's gentle support of the nasal passages reduces the soft tissue collapse that occurs in all horses during intensive exercise. 7 clinical studies prove the benefits of Flair Strips for reducing lung bleeding, reducing fatigue, and shortening recovery time. Reduce bleeding, recover faster, perform better. Prevent, protect, perform with Flair Strips. On Sunday, July 6th, watch the $1 million Queen's Plate live from Woodbine Racetrack. This year's race marks the 155th anniversary of the Queen's Plate, the first jewel in Canada's Triple Crown of Thoroughbred Racing, and the longest continuously run stakes race in North America. Woodbine will guarantee the early pick four pool at $100,000 and the late pick four pool at $250,000. Woodbine will also be offering 20-cent bet minimums on all Triactor, Pick 3, Pick 4, and Superfecta pools that afternoon. Watch the Queen's Plate live from Woodbine on Sunday, July 6th, post time 12 o'clock Eastern. For more information, visit queensplate.com.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Basic Tipton.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and really fun visit in the first half of the program, and looking forward to this second half here as well. Going to turn our attention now to the native of Sunderland, England, a former jockey who was in the midst of building his career in the saddle when that dream suddenly came to an abrupt end on May 25th, 2007. He was paralyzed when his mount, Montana Dream, clipped heels and fell in a race at Belmont Park. Following a long rehab process, he turned his attention to training and began that career in 2011, roughly 3.5 years after that horrific spill. And Andrew Lakeman is here with me on Trainer Talk this afternoon. Andrew, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking the time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, happy to have you on board here. And, you know, right before that race in which you were injured, you were quoted as saying to the Pony Girl, "I love this job. I don't know what I'd do if I couldn't ride." I guess you found out.
Yeah, that's correct. I remember that afternoon well. I was working for Mr. Jerkins again, and he had just come back from Florida, so I was looking forward to ride a lot of nice horses for him.
Yeah, and I can imagine that after a spill like that, and after everything that takes place, it had to be very difficult to really just focus on doing anything at that point.
Yeah, it was. It was quite difficult in the beginning because I had to make a lot of adjustments and a lot of changes, and the rehab alone, and just thinking, you know, what I was going to do with my life at that point.
Now, I mentioned that you're from England, and we'll spend plenty of time talking about your time in between your accident and, of course, leading up to you training horses in these past 4 years and what that's been like for you as a trainer. But I want to go back to the beginning here for just a minute to set the stage. And as you're growing up in England, was being a jockey always your number one priority?
It was. You know, I was lucky. I grew up on a farm in England. My grandfather had a farm. So I always had horses there that I could ride. And then I started competing in shows, just local shows, when I was 5 years old. And I continued doing that until I was 14. And it was time to move on to bigger horses. But within that industry, it is very costly, and my parents really couldn't afford to purchase better horses for me to ride. And that is when I had a friend who had an Arabian horse that he used to race. And every afternoon when I would finish school, I would go out there, take a bus like 35 minutes, and I would exercise that horse and get him ready for a race. And I was 15 at that time, and he actually won. And that gave me more encouragement. You know, I knew from a very young age that that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a jockey.
Which person or persons helped you most when you were in England as you were getting started with that riding career?
Well, what happened, I had a friend in England also that worked for an owner, and he had a lot of jumping horses and steeplechase horses. So I started to go there on weekends and gallop those horses. And I was really looking forward to finishing school, and I had finished my exams, and I wrote a letter to the British Racing School in Newmarket, and they accepted my application, and I went there for 3 months, and then they placed me with a trainer in Midlam, England, which is only an hour from my home. And I went to work for him, and I served a two-year apprenticeship with him, with Michael Hammond. And he was a former jump jockey, and he had started a train and was very successful. He didn't have a lot of flat horses. He had a lot of jumpers. But my first ride in public, I was 17, and I rode a sprinter called Flashy Sun, and I won on him my first, my very first race, and I rode him again and won on him again. So I thought, wow, you know, this is pretty easy.
Wow. What did your parents think of your decision to be a jockey?
They were actually very proud, you know, because, I mean, up until now, a lot of friends that I went to school with, you know, I lived in a very small village. And a lot of my friends and a lot of the families in England gave me a lot of support. And every time I was riding, they would watch me ride. And, you know, my parents were very supportive. And my grandfather, too. My grandfather was very proud. He was there for my first race. And I really looked up to him, you know, when I was young, for teaching me a lot of horsemanship and how to take care of horses and be the horseman that I am today.
How did you end up in the United States, Andrew?
Well, I was working for Michael Hammond, as I said, and I did a two-year apprenticeship with him. And he never had a lot of horses to run on the flat, but I rode a lot of the jumpers to get them fit to go over hurdles, which was a great experience. And I wrote a letter to Michael Dickinson. He was at Fairhill at the time. And I figured that to further my career, I would love to come to the United States and gain a lot more horsemanship with him. And he actually called me and he flew me over here within like 3 days. And I was supposed to spend 3 months with him, but it actually happened to be 2 years.
2 years with Michael Dickinson?
Yeah, I was with Michael for 2 years, and I learned a tremendous amount. Not only, you know, working horses and learn, it gave me tremendous experience, you know, working against the clock and being able to you know, get horses to relax and finish in their breezes. I also rode a bunch of races for him, Delaware and Laurel. But, you know, not only did he teach me a tremendous amount, you know, as a jockey, but he taught me a tremendous amount about the horse also. You know, Michael, you know, he is well known, you know, for his great accomplishments with Da Horse and Tappet and a lot of other horses that he had trained. He's not only one of the best horsemen I've ever worked for, but he was a perfectionist at what he did, and he loved the horses, and the horses loved him, and me and him had a great relationship. I had an excellent relationship with his wife, Joan Wakefield, who is actually from my town in Sunderland. So she took a liking to me, and that helped a great deal, and I had a tremendous experience with them.
Visiting with trainer Andrew Lakeman here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So when was it, Andrew, that you finally decided, hey, I want to try and be a jockey here in the States full-time, this is what I want to do?
Well, after Michael, I went back home for a while, and I rode a few more races. You know, in England, you know, we have to do, like, everything, you know, like, take care of the horses and muck them out in the mornings and ride them at exercise. And we only really get to ride, like, 3 horses a day, where over here I was riding 10 a day. So when I went back with that experience, that helped me. I went to Newmarket, and I worked for a trainer called William Haggis, and he gave me a lot of mounts. And then I wasn't doing too well, and I was working for Gary Moore, who is the father for Ryan Moore now, who is a great jockey in England. And I rode for him and his father for a while. And then I was riding at Lingfield one day, and a gentleman from Belgium put me on a horse, the leading trainer out there. And I went on that horse, and he asked me if I would go over there and ride for him as his stable jockey the next summer. So I took him up on that, and I went over there, and I rode a lot of races over there. I won a bunch of races over there. I got to ride in France and Germany on weekends, and that experience was great. And then after a year, I went back home. I took a little time out because I had been very hard on myself, you know, them first 5 years. You know, I'm 5'8" tall, and I had to keep my weight at 114 pounds, which was, you know, a daily struggle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I know that was a big part of, even when you came here to the States and you were riding here, that was a big part of the battle that you faced when you were riding, was trying to keep that weight in check, and you went to great measures in order to do that.
Yeah, I did. I actually used to run in plastic like 3 miles a day, and you know, in the sauna for hours at a time, and you know, everything that I ate, I learned over here. You know, the jockeys, they flip to keep their weight down, so that was a big help, but in the long run, you know, it is a tremendous stress on your health.
Yeah, and even outside of the weight issues, when you were riding, you went through a stretch where you were really battling other addictions as well, with drug and with alcohol addictions, and you came through that now with flying colors, but I know that couldn't have been easy.
No, that was very difficult. You know, I knew that I had a problem, but I didn't know how to get out of it, and I had gotten a little bit of trouble, you know, with Naira and tested positive, and they had directed me to a program here they have at Belmont Park, and I was going there, and I was doing well for a while, and then I slipped up again, and, you know, in 2005, I was working for Mr. Jerkins, and I was galloping some of the best 2-year-olds he had from when they were 2 till they were 3. And I galloped Warfront, Political Force, who was a very difficult horse to ride, and Alan Jerkins, you know, still tells the story of how I got that horse to win a grade one. You know, we had five other riders in the barn, and they couldn't ride one side of him. And, you know, he took a liking to me, and I really took a liking to him, and we got along great. And that year of 2005, I went to Saratoga, and I won my first race at Saratoga on a filly called Twelve Flipperoo, who the next year I had rode her all over 2-year-old Korea. And the next year I was drinking again, and they wouldn't let me ride any races. And I missed, you know, riding Swerve Flipperoo in the test, which she won, and missed shop in the Alabama. And that was the, that would have been the highlight of my career. And that's what I always wanted my whole life. But those demons got the best of me at that time, and I missed out. So I never really got to show, you know, the rider that I really was.
How did you react to that situation, Andrew? Did you think about maybe giving up, or did you maybe get a little bit stronger because of that?
Well, actually, in the fall, you know, I had made a decision that I was going to stop drinking. So I went and talked to a counselor that they have here, Raymond Maldonado, and he had called and spoke to the state, and they had written up a consent saying they would like me to go into a rehab for 30 days and come out and spend 30 more days in the program, and then after that, they may or may not grant me a license back. So I got through all of that, and I did as they asked. And I was 8 months clean and sober, and waiting. I rode a few horses in the winter, waiting for Mr. Jerkins to come back. And then in May, we were really looking forward to going to Saratoga. And then I had my accident.
And of course, that accident occurring, as we mentioned earlier, May 25th, 2007, your Mount Montana Dream clips heels, you fall, and then other horses fall over you, and you were pretty much trampled at that point. The injuries were significant, and quite honestly, Andrew, it's hard to believe that you're even talking with me here today.
It is, you know, I mean, it was a horrific fall, and I don't really remember much of it. I actually spoke to the ambulance driver the other day, and he was telling me when he got to me, I was totally unconscious and out, and they had taken off one of my boots, and there was no feeling in my feet, so they knew then that it was connected to the spinal cord. But when I got to the hospital, apparently, you know, I was bleeding out, and I lost a tremendous amount of blood because of the damage. I severely severed my spinal cord at T5, which left me paralyzed from my chest down, but I also broke 5 ribs, puncturing both lungs. I cracked my sternum in 3 places, fractured C1, 3, and 5 in my neck. And my blood pressure was so low that they lost me on the table 3 times. And, you know, I think a year after I went to meet the surgeon, you know, that really saved my life. And he hugged me and he cried and he said, you know, I've never in 25 years of been doing what I was doing experienced, you know, the injuries that you had had and you had survived. And it was, you know, a bad fall, but a tough fall, you know. But I watched, after a month, I think I watched the replay of the race, And I had had falls like that before and just walked away, but I guess that day was the day that all riders dread.
Well, and you had already overcome so much in getting to that point, and you must have felt like your career was back on track again. You had overcome the alcohol addiction. You were riding for Alan Jerkins. Things were on the upswing. And then this happens. What was your mood like after the accident, and how much of a struggle was it?
Well, I remember waking up. I remember one morning, I don't know when it was, waking up, and I saw my sister there and my parents, and I wasn't really aware what was going on. And I actually paralyzed my vocal cords. They said that I might never speak again. So I could just lip speak, and I remember asking my sister, you know, what are you doing here? And she replied, oh, we come to see you because you never come to see us. And then after a while, I remember one of the doctors came in and was very blunt. He just told me outright, you're never going to walk again.
Wow.
So when I went to Mount Sinai after 3 months for my rehabilitation, it was a long, difficult road. And a lot of the times I spent crying, you know, asking why, you know. It was very frustrating. But, you know, when I came out of Mount Sinai, my mom had stayed here with me for like 6 months. And my family wanted to take me back to England, but I had other plans. You know, I had a goal that I was going to train. And they suggested, you know, you don't really have anything to prove to anybody. And I said, well, I have to prove it to myself. So I kept that idea, and I moved on and went forward with that.
And there was a point afterwards, you were actually so depressed that you considered suicide at one point, right?
Yeah, well, I was getting feelings, you know, when I was alone by myself. You know, I guess the medication had a lot to do with it, too. You know, I thought, you know, what is the point of being here if I can't ride? You know, that is the love of my life. What am I going to do? And then when I started to read a lot, and I was actually reading a book on a third-generation horseman, Elliot Birch, and in part of the book, he explained, you know, his family had been in the business for a long time, and the way he would get started was to buy his own horse, and then he could make his own decisions and go from there. And when I read that, that kind of stuck, and that's what I went on and did.
Well, I know you had to battle the alcohol again after the accident. Your weight ballooned up to right around 255 pounds. You went back to Ray Maldonado again and got the counseling, and you're now back on track, stronger than ever. Your first year of training horses, you come back, you have one horse in the barn, a three-year-old colt named The Sky's a Beauty. Tell me about that year.
Well, I have a friend who's in Florida right now who has a training center, and he is partners with another gentleman, Carlos Morales. And I galloped some really nice horses for him in the year 2000. One really nice horse I galloped for him was True Direction. And we had a really good relationship. And when he never forgot about me, and we always stayed very close. And I called him one day, and I told him, can you find me a horse? I'm going to train. And he said to me, what kind of money do you want to spend? And I said around like 30, 40. thousand. And he said okay, and he had called me back, and he always had a great eye for a young horse. And he called me back and told me he had this horse that he had bought at the Basic Tipton yearling sale by Sky Mesa. And he thought that that horse would fit. So Carlos drove the horse all the way from Florida himself, and I went on to training him.
How challenging is it training horses from a wheelchair?
It has been challenging, but, you know, getting up every morning at 4:30, you know, I have a routine, you know, I can't really, which takes me around an hour and a half, 2 hours, with other complications also. And then, but when I'm in my wheelchair, I have a really good nurse. When I'm in my wheelchair, you know, I'm off and I'm free. You know, I have a van, which I'm really grateful for. A lot of supporters and friends raised a lot of money with the BEST program. So I was able to buy a van that I drive, and it has a ramp to go with my wheelchair. My wheelchair locks in the actual van, and I forget, you know, that I'm in the wheelchair. I forget about the pain, you know, when I'm around the horses. It's like every horse I've had, they kind of know that I'm in the wheelchair. Like when I bought this guy's a beauty, I could go in the stall to check his legs. I could be right beside him. And every horse I've had, when I train, I go with them to the track, right by their side, walk through the tunnels, take them to the paddock. And they would never hurt me. It's like, you know, they are aware of it. And I've been very lucky that way.
Talking with trainer Andrew Lakeman on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Andrew, just about 2 minutes left. This has really flown by, but I do want to ask you quickly about your first 2 years. You saddle that one winner in your first year, four winners in the second year, and then you haven't trained or saddled a winner in 2013 or 2014 so far. Is that difficult to maintain that positive attitude when you're not winning?
It is. You know, I've been very lucky. You know, I did saddle four winners that year. You know, I saddled a first-time starter with Cheese Loker. I had a horse that I bought from Pancho Martin just before his death. He sold me the horse for $1. And the horse was by City Zip. He was a five-year-old maiden. He was 0 for 32. He was with five really very respectful trainers. And I took him and I got him happy. And I ran him. He was 98 to 1, drawn all the way in the outside, going 6 furlongs on the turf in a maiden special weight. And he finished second. And I won a maiden special weight with him. And Rosina Pavrick rode him. And I had a lot of success with Ramon Dominguez, who is, you know, one of my greatest heroes and my friend. He lives right next to me. And I did well, you know, with the horses that I've had with very limited amounts of money. And I just trained kind of private for myself, and Carlos sent me a couple of horses I won with. And now I just sent out a lot of letters and resumes to a lot of owners and farms in Kentucky and Florida or Ocala, because now I'm ready to take the next step forward and start training for other people and get their horses to win races in New York.
Well, Andrew, it's been an amazing story. Hearing your story here tonight has been so inspirational. All the best moving forward, and anything we can do to help here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, please let us know.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, just looking for new owners, and if there's anybody out there, you know, I would love to train for them and do a great job.
Andrew, thanks so much. Andrew Lakeman here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. What a story. Talk about inspirational. Andrew Lakeman sums it up. Hope you enjoyed the program here tonight. Don't forget, if you missed any portion of podcast, available on our website, horseracingradio.net. For my producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.